Katya, if you were asked, what do we need to look into in order to understand and protect ourselves from climate change? What comes in mind?
I mean, this is a very important question, that's for sure. Maybe I'd think that we should study carbon dioxide, something related to the atmosphere. Trees come to mind.
Well, let's listen to today's episode to find out. The Science Basement! Hello and welcome. You are listening to the Science Basement podcast, a podcast for people who love all things science. I'm your host, Eleana.
And I'm your co-host, Katya.
And today, we are talking about temperature adaptation of mound-building wood ants. Our guest is Beatriz Portiña, a PhD student at the Evolutionary Genetics Lab of the University of Lisbon and the Spaciant Lab at the University of Helsinki. Hello to both of you, Katya and Beatriz.
Hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining us and welcome to our podcast, Beatriz. I find the title very, very interesting, but maybe we can start this episode by asking you, Beatriz, why are we talking about ants today?
Okay, so here in Finland, we have two species of ants that hybridize and they create hybrid populations. And the cool thing about this is that one of the parents is adapted to hot temperatures and the other one is adapted to cold temperatures. And in our group here in Helsinki, we found that the hybrids have the same hot temperature tolerance as one of their parents. And we also found that they can very quickly adapt to changes in temperature. So on a year-to-year basis, they will have more variation from their warm adapted parents or from their cold adapted parents in response to the mean temperature in April, which is when the eggs start being laid and reared.
So in some sense, it doesn't matter if it's warm or cold, these kind of children will adapt to both kind of environments.
Yeah. And very quickly, which is great because with climate change, we are seeing these very quick changes in the environments of different species. And one very big problem of climate change is that species might not be able to adapt as fast as the environments are changing.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I think especially in a place where, like Finland, where you're studying the ants, where, you know, the temperature has changed so drastically in quite a short time period relative to other parts of the world. This feature of having the hot adaption versus the cold adaption is very useful. You mentioned the word hybridization and hybrid ants. What exactly does that mean?
So a hybridization happens when there are two different, we can say species or even populations, that have adapted independently, that then they meet and they create offspring that has genetic variation from both of these parents, which is the same as when you have two people that have a child and then the child has DNA from both of their parents.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so now we're talking at an ant level. Are there any other species that form these hybrids?
Oh, yeah, because a while ago, hybridization was, we thought that it was really uncommon. But now we've seen more and more examples, and we've now realized that it is very, very common in animals, because previously plant biologists accepted hybridization as a common thing. But as we know more, we know that hybridization is very, very common across many animals. We have examples from fish, from daphnias, which are little creatures that live in water, in lakes. And
maybe one very common example that most of the people are aware of is the mule, right?
Yes, the mule is a hybrid between a horse and a donkey. But the mule is a bad hybrid because they are all sterile.
However, these ant species hybrid species we are talking about today is like a happy hybrid because it benefits from both of its parents.
Yes. And they have been, these ants have been around for a while.
And you touched a little bit at the beginning about the importance of this knowledge about, and also characteristic these ants have for adjusting to temperatures, and you put it in the perspective of the climate change. So maybe we can dive a little bit deeper in what are the advantages and why is it worth it to further investigate this kind of property of this hybrid ant species.
So one of the main problems with adaptation to climate change is that if we are thinking about species and populations adapting to these very fast changes in their environments by new mutations that will give them an advantage in this new environment, this is a very slow process. So the main idea that we have is that a fast and useful adaptation to climate change will be through standing genetic variation. And standing genetic variation means everything that the species already have in their DNA that is not useful in their base environment. But then when the environment changes, this this variation that they already have becomes good for them to adapt. So in this hybrid populations of the ants, we have a lot of standing genetic variation that is useful in different conditions. So it will be, well, I think and hope that it will be quicker for them to adapt to climate change because they are hybrids. So because they have the variation of both of their parents.
I find this to be a very interesting point in the sense that I am thinking, because I'm not from biology, of course, and please correct me, both of you, if I say something wrong. But what I'm thinking is that if we look at species through time, like from specimens we have, from fossils, and even humans, like how they developed, it was a very slow process. And their adaptation to their new environment was happening slowly. And if there were drastic changes, then species vanished. You are saying now that you have these ants that they do carry this genetic property of adapting to the temperatures. They may not need it now, so they don't use it. But then if temperature suddenly changes, they are ready to defend or protect themselves against that. And is this somehow important for us as humans?
Yes, because by studying this this system, we will have things that can be applied to many other species. And as humans, we tend to think, okay, adaptation to climate change, how will human populations adapt? But we exist in a network, so we are part of an ecosystem. So if other species collapse, it's bad for us. So it's important for us to do our best and the most to maintain biodiversity.
So it's not only about our immediate survival, it's about the survival of all the world around us, the animal kingdom around us, and therefore our survival within that environment. Does it also apply to plants?
Yes and no, because plants are a bit more complicated than animals, and they have increased challenges because they can't move. So animals have it a little bit easier because they can just change where they are. Yeah. But plants have it a little bit harder. But I think in theory it may be applicable to plants as well.
Okay, that's promising, at least to even think that as a possibility. But I understand I sidetracked the episode, so maybe we can go back to the main focus, which is this hybrid ant species. And so you are here in Finland, but you're also doing your PhD in Portugal. Where do we find this species population? Are they existing also in Portugal and Finland and somewhere else?
So the two parents, the cold adapted one has a more is distributed more in the north of Europe, and the warm adapted one is distributed more towards the south, and they overlap, so they both exist here in Finland and in Switzerland as well. But in Switzerland, they occupy different altitudes.
Oh, and right. Makes sense, because it's so like... Yeah. There are mountains there.
And Finland is so flat.
Exactly.
Yes. And what is also interesting in Switzerland is that because there's so much altitudinal difference, there are also temperature differences, mm-hmm. yes. I Makes expect. Sense. Yeah. Especially even in the summertime, you might go up the Alps and still be a little bit chilly, yeah. I assume.
Yeah. And here in Finland, we think that because of the way that the forests are managed, there's these clear cuts of the forest, so they... A part of the forest is completely logged, and then the cold-adapted parent likes the shade, and the warm-adapted parent can tolerate having their nests more in the sun, so they have a little bit of an easier time meeting in Finnish forests.
Now. I know what I'll be doing next time I'm in the woods and I see an ant's nest. I'll be like, oh, that's under a tree in the shade. It's probably a cold thermoregulating ants there.
The more you know.
But when you start looking for ants and you go to the forest, you find them everywhere here because they build these huge mounds. And so you look and, oh, there's a mound. Is that a nest? And it often is.
Yeah, once I did cover myself with ants because it was my first time in Finland. I didn't know. So I went by a big mound and I didn't know that's an ant nest.
They're very aggressive.
Yeah, oh, they are. Yeah. They're climbing on my legs.
Yes.
Oh, no. I've also heard this fun fact that ants are found on almost every continent around the world.
There are so many species of ants. And it's like incredible biodiversity in ants.
Yes, actually, as a side note for the listeners, we did another episode on ants not so long ago with Jason Rissanen. So there he talks about how ants are ecosystem engineers, which I found really cool. I had no idea before that.
Yeah, and this particular ants, these two mound-building wood ants, are what we call keystone species in boreal forests. And a keystone species is something that if this is gone... then the ecosystem collapses. So ants have very important functions, like ecological functions.
Oh gosh, okay. So ants are clearly incredibly important for the environment, our ecosystems and everything. And we should research their characteristics and understand them. And I think our audience would really be interested in understanding how you conduct your research.
So I use two different main methods. I use computer simulations and experiments. So now I'm getting ready to do this very, very cool experiment where we put queens, which are the individuals, the females in these ant societies that lay eggs, and they're responsible for the creation of the offspring. And I'm going to see how temperature affects the number of eggs that they lay. So under different temperatures in the lab, I'm going to see how many eggs they lay and what are the differences under different temperatures. And then something very, very cool that we're going to do is we're also going to let the eggs that they lay develop at these temperatures until they hatch into larvae. And this is one of my favorite things in my PhD project, we will sequence eggs and sequence larvae, and hopefully we'll be able to see how their genetic variation changes under different temperatures. So how temperature is selecting them.
Because you used the word sequencing, and I don't think many of our readers will know exactly what that entails, could you maybe share a few more details about it?
When we sequence things, ants, whatever, we are basically reading what their DNA is. So we can know, okay, this individuals or this group of individuals have this variation in their DNA.
And so am I right in understanding that you can also then compare the sequences? So for example, you said you were growing the eggs and mm-hmm. then the larvae at the different temperatures. Yeah. So then you can kind of compare the DNA sequences of the at these different temperatures.
Exactly, yes. And then we can see what changes from eggs, so before they are selected by the temperature, until they hatch into larvae when they've already gone through this period of stress.
That's really cool that we're able to even research that. And especially with the temperatures changing, this is really relevant and topical knowledge to know how the temperature is going to affect the DNA. And I guess you can follow it for several generations as well.
Well, this we haven't figured out yet with this particular ants how to rear them in the lab, because they are they need things that we can't really have in the lab.
You can't provide for them. Yeah.
Mm-mm.
But it is really cool. And what we find out with these ants about the genetic part of adaptation to temperature, it's always also applicable to other species, either other species of ants, other animals.
Yeah. At least we know that temperature can define the gender of crocodile eggs, if I remember.
I haven't heard this one before.
Or turtles. I don't remember which. Yeah, but I think like based on the temperature, it will be a male or a female hatchling.
True. Which is a really big problem because the temperature difference for crocodile eggs comes from how deep they bury them. But when the soil is hotter, further down, so then they are having like only one sex, which is very bad.
Yeah, that's going to be very problematic with the global heating happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if the temperature is around 30, the hatchlings are female. And if the temperature is around 34, they are males. So there's something. I mean, I remember seeing it in documentaries, but now that you were talking about the ants, it just came to my mind.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. And so you said that you study the ants through these observations. Do you use any other method?
I use computer simulations where we can have simulated populations evolving under things that we know. So we know what's happening to them. And then we can see how that, what are the effects of that, of those processes that we impose on the simulated populations in the long term. And these are really, really versatile and less intrusive because we don't have to deal with live animals. And they're a really, really great tool for these kinds of things and for many things in evolutionary biology.
Okay, so computer models. As a mostly wet lab scientist myself, I'm not very familiar with how computer models work. You mentioned that you can study the characteristics of the hybrid populations using computer models. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, just a parenthesis first for the audience. Wet lab scientists means they deal with cells in the lab and not with computers. Did I say that right, Katja?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Very good interjection.
I had to explain it, but now the floor is yours, Beatrice.
Yeah, so in evolution, there are a lot of things that happen. There's what we call neutral processes, that are things that always happen to populations as they evolve through time. And there are selective processes, which is essentially selection. So with the power of simulations, we know what are the processes that are affecting a particular simulated population. And so we can see how those processes shape populations and through time. So as they evolve, like what is the effect of this particular thing on a population? And then we can combine many things. We can test different strengths of different processes. And it is really, really cool.
By different strengths of different things, what do you mean by that?
So imagine that you were studying how migration affects your populations, and you can simulate the same population under a scenario where you have no migration. So there are no individuals that are moving between populations, and
the ant individuals.
Sure.
Yeah.
Or even simulated individuals.
Okay.
So abstract individuals. So imagine you were like simulating a population of fish, two populations of fish. And you can simulate a scenario where you have no fish moving between populations. So there is no gene flow, what we call gene flow, when there is a migrant that enters a population and mates there. And then you have the flow of genes between the populations because you then create some hybrid individuals in a population. And then you can test different levels of migration. So you can then have a scenario where you have the exact same population, but you increase the number of migrants to two. So each generation or each year, you have two migrants leaving population A to population B, and then two fish leaving population B to population A. And then you can play with these parameters, and you can see very clearly what happens to your simulated populations under these different migration rates. That's, yes.
So you apply this method to ants, and I have to ask, is the outcome of this model a stochastic process, or will it always be the same? So if you repeat the computational experiment from the start and you start moving two to the one and two to the other, and every year you repeat that, will you end up with the same result, or will the process every time you start the experiment from zero change?
We expect that it changes a little bit because there is some randomness associated.
Okay.
It's consistent. So we don't only do one simulation,
mm-hmm.
we do several
mm-hmm.
simulations, and then we look at the outcome of all of them together.
So it's like a collective analysis then of the results.
Okay, so you talked about neutral processes and that these are processes that always happen. But then are there some selective processes?
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm going to look at is what we call fluctuating selection, which is a type of selection where the pressure is on different individuals at different times. So, for example, in the ants, we have hybrids that have the potential to be cold adapted and the potential to be warm adapted. So when we do this fluctuating selection, we have a period of time where being warm adapted is being selected for, so it's good for them to be warm adapted. And then the following period of time, what is being selected for is being cold adapted. So we have this literally fluctuating selection happening, and it is really, really cool. And I am very excited to do it.
Yeah, it does sound very cool, like very like topical to what you were studying.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a very interesting and very informative conversation for me, Beatrice, because I'm, as I said, I'm not from biology or nowhere near your field of research, but also many of our listeners are like me, and we asked them what questions they would like to ask you. So here are some that came through. The one question was, what is the range of temperature ants typically have to adapt to? For example, if the temperature goes down below a certain degree, will they die or will they go in hibernation?
Yeah, they hibernate for the winter. And then around this time, well, April, beginning of April, when it starts to get warm and the sun starts hitting them, the nests and the snow melts, then they start becoming active on top of the nests. And they are this red mound building wood ants, but they're quite dark. So they absorb so much heat and then just heat the nest by being on top of it. And that's when the queens come out as well to sun themselves on top of the nest. And it is really cool, but then the ants are very scary and when they're very active.
Okay.
I was just picturing like this sunbathing ants.
Right. I think you're longing for summer, Katya.
I think so.
For those who are listening, this episode is recorded in April in Finland, where it's currently actually warm. 8 degrees.
13 degrees today.
But I think that says a lot that we're saying that 8 degrees is warm.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. So I will read a couple more questions from our audience. One of our listeners asked, do ants sweat?
No, because they don't have, so they're invertebrates and they don't have temperature regulation like mammals do, like we do.
Okay.
So we sweat because we can regulate our own temperature.
Yes.
And ants can't do that.
Okay, that's interesting.
So it's just kind of selected for, basically, with the genes is how they regulate, if you will.
Yeah, exactly, how resistant they are.
Oh.
Cool. And maybe one last question I will ask, because I did like it a lot. It says, do ants from one hive try to bring ants from another hive as workers?
In this particular species, no. But there are some species that do social parasitism. So the way that they build new nests, new colonies, is that a queen will go into another species colony, sometimes kill the queen, and then make those workers work for her while she's laying her own workers.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's very... Oh, wow.
That's so brutal.
Yes.
Yes. Ant world is brutal. That's good. Well, thank you very much to the audience for these amazing questions.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. And maybe before we wrap up the episode, I don't know if Katya, you would like to ask something else.
No, I was just going to ask, Beatrice, do you have a take-home message for us?
Yeah, because we can study such important things with such tiny little organisms, and what we find from these ants can be applied to so many other species. And so people usually tend to think, oh, ants don't matter, this doesn't matter, why are we studying this? But they are actually very important and valuable to learn more about temperature adaptation for climate change.
And this is an important message also from another perspective, because many people think that when you study ants or fish, what's the value for our society? And clearly with this work you are doing, you're demonstrating that understanding other species' behavior has a great value for our own species.
Exactly.
And this is a very important message to also add or attach to what you just said.
Indeed.
Yes. Thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
And before we go away, Katya, what's the fun fact of the day?
Okay. So today's fun fact, I was thinking along this temperature lines that we were going on, not exactly in ants, but you'll hear in a second. So my fun fact is that hot water can freeze faster than cold water.
Yeah, because the molecules are more energized. So they lose temperature more quickly.
Yeah, it's the classic experiment you have seen in so many YouTube videos of people throwing like a hot tea or hot water in the freezing cold, and then you see it immediately solidifying in the air.
Yes, exactly. And recreating these, or, you know, making these beautiful photos as well with the sun in the background and this ice flying.
Well, shame on me, because I've been living in Finland for 9 years almost and I haven't done that. No, I'm waiting for the next winter or summer. Please don't come. Well, thank you very much, Katya, for the fun fact, and Beatrice for joining us for this episode. Good luck with your future work.
Thank you very much.
Yes, and to our listeners, goodbye, and well, you'll hear us the next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye. If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up. Rate us on the podcasting app of your choice, and don't forget to share it with your friends. This podcast was produced by The Science Basement, a science communication organization based in Helsinki, Finland. Interested in getting involved or being interviewed? Get in touch at podcast@thesciencebasement.org.